Hello and welcome to the Guardian Film Show. Dancing through the city in search of a movie to love. This week we find ourselves a little lost, a little confused, unsure exactly which direction to turn. The only response is a hollow ha-ha. Here are the suitors to choose between. Blackfish is the strong, silent type, highly intelligent, but prone to certain violent tendencies. Days of Grace is noisy and nimble, shouting Spanish down the hall with its pistol fully loaded. And the Wolverine is big and brooding, with a god-awful sense of humour and a passing resemblance to a peevish Hugh Jackman. Hello, ladies. We begin, however, with the fetching Francis Ha, a Generation Y comedy directed by Noah Baumbach and starring Greta Gerwig as a wannabe dancer who collides with hard reality. And here's Gerwig to show us all the steps.
I just got a tax rebate. Do you want to go to dinner?
I discovered modern dance in college, and I was never great at it, but I loved watching it, and I really loved these women who were these dancers, and really it was a kind of their story that I was drawing from, because I knew people who, when they graduated from college, became apprentices at modern dance companies, and then never joined the company. They stayed apprentices, and then at some point they had to kind of cut their losses. And I just thought that was so heartbreaking, but so necessary. And like, how much presence of mind does it take to say, like, I'm not doing it anymore?
How was it with your own career? Because you had this kind of great early rush with the sort of mumblecore movement of Hannah Takes the Stairs. And then there was a point where it was almost like the mainstream was kind of eating you up in films like No Strings Attached. When you're in those big mainstream movies, is there a part of you that's thinking, Jesus Christ, I could write better than this, but I can't do anything.
I still got to say these lines. I can't answer that question. Because, no, I mean, sometimes they let you rewrite the lines.
I asked you to move in with me. You said no.
But I can't.
You can. You don't want to.
What do you do?
It's kind of hard to explain.
Because what you do is complicated?
Because I don't really do it.
I'm joined on the dance floor by Henry Barnes and the Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw. Peter, I have the sense that Gerwig is one of these actors that people either absolutely adore or would quite like to throttle.
I'm kind of going for the third way, rather. I'm not totally bought into the Greta Gerwig thing. I really wanted to like this film. Our colleague Catherine Shard loved it, absolutely loved it when it was in Toronto, and I liked it. I wanted it to be funnier. How can I say this? I think I get Greta Gerwig's style, which is very naturalistic, which isn't, the point of it isn't to hammer you with gags and lines and zingers. It really reminded me of Lena Dunham. I mean, in its overwhelming and I think slightly self-conscious hipness, it was saying we are hip. We are from Brooklyn and we are hip in almost
and
every
the casting
frame.
Casting as well, Adam Driver is in there
intensely, Lena Dunham, lots of references and then scenes which are similar to Lena Dunham. But I have to say, without Lena Dunham's killer instinct for the excruciating situation or the gag. Now, that might just be the vulgar way my palate has been slightly corroded by a need for gags, and that's not what this movie is trying to do.
It's gentler.
Yeah, it is gentler, and I get that. But if I'm honest, I have to say I was waiting for some punch, some killer punch, which didn't quite come for me.
Henry, as someone at the end of your 20s still casting around for an honourable way to spend your life, did this movie strike a chord?
Yeah, it feels almost too close to home. Yeah. No, I mean, that's exactly the reason why I hated all the mumblecore stuff, in that it's all about, you know, the glory of being in your 20s and not really knowing what you're doing and blah, 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 blah. And this has gotten far more direction, is much more of a target, I think. And I think the hipness thing works because she isn't hip, and she's now getting to that point where she's starting to head into her 30s, and she still has no clue what's going on. And it's a bit sad compared to the people around her who actually do have functioning jobs, are able to get a flat, which she can't do, and seem to have at least halfway decent relationships, which she's just come out of. So while normally I'd absolutely hate Greta Gerwig, and not much of a fan of Noah Baumbach either, I really love this. I thought it was great.
Baumbach and Gerwig are what is known in gossip terms as an item.
An item.
And he was telling me that he was kind of motivated by a desire to protect the character and, by implication, Gerwig herself. And it's a very tender, compassionate portrait of somebody who is a complete mess.
I think you can be tender and compassionate to people who are in that situation, though. I mean, you know, there is an element of disillusionment and dysfunction in people in their late 20s who don't know still what they want to do, which comes across really well in this. One part that I absolutely loved is where she goes home to her family, and he does this montage of 5 minutes maybe of 45-second scenes of her doing things like going to the dentist's or putting lights on the tree. And that felt completely true to me, that you can still go home and feel like a kid in many ways and then come back to the real world of New York and have absolutely no clue what's going on and be completely lost.
Although I do have to say that is Lena Dunham. Lena Dunham, and maybe Frances Hard got in there first, but that is a big scene in Girls, going home to the West Coast to your parents.
It adds to the poignancy, though, doesn't it?
Oh, because it does.
They're not mockable. It's not like she's run away and rebelled from anything. She's just kind of different.
She's just different. What I like about it is, I understand to be sort of the point, is just her sheer youth. The sheer physiological motor is turning over so that she doesn't get depressed. And you have that terrific scene where she's literally running, jazz running through the streets to David Bowie's Modern Love. It kind of reminded me weirdly of Kenneth Lonergan's Margaret, really, a kind of horrible B-side to that. That's the desperation of running in that movie, which of course ended in utter disaster. This really reminded me of that scene, that terrific tracking shot where she's possibly running for a bus, or possibly she's just late or just running for the sheer hell of it, but with a more optimistic spin.
It's that thing when you're with someone and you love them and they know it and they love you and you know it, but it's a party and you're both talking to other people and you're laughing and shining and you look across the room and catch each other's eyes. But not because you're possessive or it's precisely sexual, but because that is your person in this life. And it's funny and sad, but only because this life will end, and it's the secret world that exists right there in public, unnoticed, that no one else knows about.
Greta Gerwig getting put through her paces in the lovely Frances Ha. And now, at the risk of getting whiplash, we move on to a very different beast. Blackfish tells the story of the killer whales plucked from the wild and delivered to the aquapark, often with disastrous results. The film looks like this and is directed by Gabriella Cowperthwaite.
Don is the senior trainer here at Shamu Stadium.
She captured what it means to be a SeaWorld trainer, that it made me realize what happened to her really could have happened to anyone.
I've been expecting somebody to be killed by a tilikum.
We weren't told much about it, other than it was trainer error.
We can't be blamed, I think, 40 years ago for wanting to understand these animals and for wanting to educate ourselves and communicate with them or whatever. But given the fact that now we've learned what we've learned about them and we know that we are not equipped to provide them what they need, the experiment has to stop.
We stored these whales in what we call a module, which was 20 feet across and 30 feet deep, and the lights were all turned out.
Probably led to what I think is a psychosis.
From what we know about them, they're just almost a higher caliber of intelligence than I think anybody really sort of appreciates. So the fact that you're kind of confining that animal to such this concrete small enclosure and subjecting it to the same tricks sort of day in and day out, you know, I think there are theories that this caused him to snap and that they all whales will eventually exhibit signs of frustration.
Henry, we saw an example of this in Jacques Audiard's Rust and Bone last year, but this really kind of broadens it all out into what is almost a kind of viral conspiracy that's going on.
is, and it's one of those things that you watch a film like this and you think, of course it's not right to keep these animals, which are incredibly intelligent, in these confined spaces. Of course it's not right to pay money to go and see them and cheer at them and expect them to do the same old rote tricks over and over and over again. But it does take watching a film like this to remind you that these things are going on. We probably should be doing something about it. It's a tad clumsily made. It's a little bit long, this, but it's really heartfelt, and it's particularly excellent on talking to the former trainers at places like SeaWorld and discovering the relationship that they think they're building with these giant animals.
Well, they're not demonised at all, are they?
They're not at all.
Many of them are motivated to stay longer despite all of their qualms because they want to protect these animals.
And she's very sincere about that relationship, but at the same time she's saying these are wild animals that you can never truly know, in the same way as something like Herzog's Grizzly Man. Mm. She's saying we constantly project our human values onto these animals and constantly think that they're happy for us to look after them in this way and be their friends, when in actual fact they never asked to be here. It's completely unnatural for them to be here, and the effect of that is that they can have borderline psychotic outbreaks which might lead to accidents.
It's incredible how much of the action they actually film at the aquaparks, which makes that archive footage absolutely harrowing when you eventually get to see it.
It really is. When I saw Rust and Bone, I think, like a lot of people, in my naivety and absurdity, I sort of thought that was a bizarre fictional one-off created for Rust and Bone. Of course it's not. There have been many, many incidents of these things, all of them covered up, and there's a huge number of corporate complicity in this. And basically, you've got these huge beasts. They're called killer whales, remember, although they don't want to kill human beings in the wild, but they certainly want to kill them now. And in a way, these aren't accidents. They have gone mad. We've driven them mad. And there is something as gripping as a thriller, watching the psychosis of these whales as they slowly begin to lose it.
Peter says it's as gripping as a thriller, but you disagree. You think it's just more of a straight expose.
I think it starts as a thriller about one whale in particular, Tilikum, who was taken into captivity and then caused accidents which led to the deaths of three different trainers. So it's almost like a portrait of a serial killer style thing for the first 45 minutes of that. And then it does drift off into open water and talks about the broader scale of things, the larger companies like SeaWorld that tend to do these practices. I mean, it is a very one-sided film. We don't get anything from the companies themselves about their working conditions.
Well,
or
we have a lot
safety.
Of footage, a lot of their adverts.
We do
which
have
is
a lot of their adverts.
That's their public
and
face.
In actual fact, they came out this week and said SeaWorld disowned the film and said this is absolute nonsense. You're not talking about any of the safety records, any of the animal treatment. But when I spoke to Gabriela Cowper, she said she went to them for a statement.
They did.
And they've never actually given one.
It's in the film. They say we approach them repeatedly and they refuse to.
Yeah.
They refuse to get involved.
I mean, so while you could say a good documentary would really, really try and see both sides of the story, increasingly as you watch it, you think I'm not sure there are two sides. I think this is.
Yeah, exactly.
A great argument.
And also, we've heard the other side for 30 years.
40 odd years
that this practice has been going on.
Yeah, this romantic ideal that you can keep these wild animals.
And they love it. They're doing it because they love doing the backflips and jumping up and down and all that.
Yes, and it's a travesty. It's a travesty. But there is something horrible about it as well. I mean, it would be irresponsible of this movie just to make it like the portrait of a serial killer. And yet it is like that because it is a way in which psychosis and dysfunction has been bred and designed into all these creatures. I mean, the whale Tilikum, the key offender, has been bred for whales which are highly likely to have the same predispositions and kept in similar conditions all over the world. So it is a kind of global nightmare. I found it totally gripping.
When Tilikum arrived at SeaWorld, he was attacked viciously, repeatedly by Katina and others. In the wild, it's a very matriarchal society. Male whales are kept at the perimeter in captivity. The animals are squeezed into very close proximity. Tilikum, the poor guy, is so large, he couldn't get away because he just is not as mobile relative to the smaller and more agile females. And where was he going to run? There's no place to run.
I think he spent a lot of time in isolation. SeaWorld claims that, oh no, he's always in with the females. But I mean, from what I saw, he was mostly put with the females for breeding purposes, and he didn't spend a lot of time, with the other whales.
It's for his own protection. You know, he gets beat up, and so by segregating him, it provides a physical barrier so the females can't kick his butt.
Grinning trainers and toothy orcas in the harrowing documentary Blackfish. We now move from one vision of hell to another. Days of Grace contains guns, gangsters, cops and criminals. And if there's any grace in there, it's probably in a body bag.
Mundial de fútbol. Tiempo santo donde todo vale. El mundo entra en un vértigo paralizante mientras la suerte de unos, de todos, de alguna u otra forma depende de un balón.
Gangbangers, angry loners and vengeful cops take note. If you have a score to settle or a heist to pull, it might be worth doing it during the FIFA World Cup, when the eyes of the world are glued to the games. Everardo Gout's sinewy action thriller jumps back and forth between three successive tournaments, roaring down the alleys of Mexico City, up to no good.
Yo soy esa llena. Y esta es mi selva.
So, Peter, the time to set out all your grievances is during the World Cup.
It's during the World Cup, yes. The title means the grace period that obtains in Mexico City during all World Cup tournaments, when the cops and the robbers are just too busy watching the football to do anything about their usual activities. And what the movie does is flashes backwards and forwards between the World Cups of 2002, 2006 and 2010. It's a little bit confusing.
It really
confused
me. For me anyway, all football games look the same anyway. Let alone three different tournaments.
Oh no, they're radically different. But it's supposed to be confusing in that some of the storylines are brought into parallel. They're in a way kind of superimposed on top of each other to create a sort of narrative trompe l'oeil effect. It can be a bit head-spinning and a little bit exasperating sometimes, but there's some cracking stuff in this. I mean, the opening shootout between the cops and the villains in the opening scene, it's absolutely gripping, shot as if you're really there in a real situation. It's sort of fantastic. I think it kind of loses it a little bit. It's very macho. I think it's very influenced by Elite Squad, the Brazilian film Elite Squad. A little less fetishizing of the lawman and their uniforms, because Elite Squad really went in for that. And this doesn't do it the same way. And there are a number of resemblances and indeed direct allusions to City of God. It's very much inspired by City of God, which is fair enough. And you can see the ways in which, the very explicit ways in which it's sort of structured around what it takes to be the City of God approach.
Is it anything more than cynical favela tourism?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, that is the setting. And I also think that maybe Mexican directors have got good at making that kind of film post-City of God, that you have this, you know, the yellow sheen and the racing through the favelas. And it's incredibly exciting and really well shot, this. I did come to it on the back of Heli, which was a film that was at Cannes this year, which was incredibly violent to the point where they showed genital mutilation and beheadings. And the director said about that film, this is Mexico. This is what's going on in our cities and in our towns every single day. And if you Europeans can't stand to watch it, then that's your problem, not ours. You know, don't be so precious about it. And this was strangely absent of that kind of violence.
I think that's a kind of cynicism in and of itself,
though,
isn't it?
Maybe.
Because these films play well in the West because we think, God, they're like savages, aren't they?
That there might be an element of it. But then I think if watching this film with Heli in mind, I did think, is there a responsibility to actually show more blood, more violence? And I'm not often one that will call for more violence in films, but this film felt strangely superhero-like in that there were lots of bullets flying, not many people seemed to get hit, there wasn't much blood or consequence to a lot of the violence that was going on.
Isn't this a problem for Mexican cinema in general, which is, on the one hand, separate from the US and Hollywood, and yet just proximity-wise, it's so close, so they're importing a lot of the tropes of the Hollywood action film.
Yeah, they're kind of creating, I suppose, a new exploitation genre in a way. I think what Escalante did with Heli is he conveyed the idea of anger. It wasn't simply that it was violent, but he was angry about it because we are just letting it go over and over again, particularly their neighbours, the United States, who are buying all the cocaine. There is an element of anger in that film. There's no anger in Days of Grace. They just let it go. There's a sense of, well, this is how it is, and you've got to be a real tough guy to survive. And I think there's something, I don't know whether you could call it cynical, really. It's just resigned, really, which is very different from Heli. Heli is not resigned. That film was not resigned. It was angry, whereas this isn't. This is just a straightforward, I think, genre thriller.
Yo soy esa llena. Y esta es mi selva.
That's Days of Grace giving us action aplenty. And if that still isn't enough, let's see if we can't see out the show with a crash, a bang, a few blade fights, and a bit of train surfing. This is Hugh Jackman, and this is the Wolverine Ha. James Mangold's superhero blockbuster gives us the X-Man in exile, hanging out in the woods and licking his wounds, until he's summoned to Tokyo. Next thing we know, he's tangling with the accusers, slashing stuff up, and generally marking his territory. Hugh Jackman's Wolverine is still barely house-trained. Henry, I was lying, of course, it's not called the Wolverine Ha, but it does have the definite article, which the earlier Wolverines didn't have, which gives it a kind of, sort of a weight and authority, doesn't it?
It should, yeah, because it's got a lot of, the franchise has got a lot of making up to do after X-Men Origins Wolverine, which was the last standalone film, and was just horrible, truly horrible. And it, actually, it's weird watching the marketing for this film. There's a real feeling that the filmmakers and the people around it are apologising for X-Men Origins and saying, this is the Wolverine film you've been waiting for. And it's not the Wolverine film I've been waiting for, but for fans, I think it will do the business. You know, there's plenty of him slicing and dicing and doing his thing. I think now the Marvel films and superhero films in general are coming to the point that the comic books did, where you set up your heroes, you have your understood narrative about them, they're characters in their own right, they can carry a film, but you're getting to the point where they might have to die or lose their powers or be retired for a few issues and then come back again. And it's all being chopped up and spliced and the worlds are falling into each other. And for a non-comic book fan like me, that's just the point where I'm no longer... I really couldn't care about Wolverine anymore. I couldn't care about the character. I couldn't care about his world that much. So it's incredibly difficult to keep watching these films and expect something new and interesting each time.
Peter, where does the Wolverine rank in the great pantheon of Marvel superheroes?
I don't know. It's obvious that, you know, Eddie, the franchise, the thinks that Wolverine is the breakout star, the standout star. I think it's evolved, the franchise has evolved in a pretty boring direction, really, just because Wolverine, the Wolverine, isn't very interesting on his own. The original X-Men story, I always found interesting. These mutants who came together and found in their alienation, their estrangement from the straight world, their mutant qualities were converted, of course, into superpowers. And that was sort of brilliant. But there's none of that debate now. That's all just gone. Everything about that has gone. Everything that I think is interesting about X-Men is gone.
There is also an element that the more you reveal of Wolverine, the character, the backstory that has made him this sarky, cynical guy who will throw the odd side in, the more you reveal of that, the less interesting he is
to
watch in the
moment.
Well,
he's got a lost love, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Lost love.
Oh, God. Funky Jansen floating around in a nightie.
So drippy. It's so drippy, especially as he's got to be such a sort of sub-Bogart tough guy.
Yeah.
He's got to be, hi, princess. He actually calls her princess. Don't princess her, mate. That's ridiculous.
He's a bit unreconstructed.
Well, I think Hugh Jackman is good. I think without him, it would be just nothing at all. I think he does bring... I mean, he certainly brings the muscle. I mean, he has spent what looks like 8 months in the gym, because he really is big for this part. He really is ridiculously big. And he does bring something to it. I mean, he's not just a bland, pretty boy. He does bring something to it. But it's a bland, bland, boring role. What a boring film, frankly.
Hugh Jackman howling at the moon in The Wolverine. That's it from us. We have howled ourselves hoarse. My thanks as ever to the Peter Bradshaw and the Henry Barnes. I'm off next week, but the film show continues. Do be sure to pull up a chair.